Get that Amex Gold card ready. I'm too tired to cook.
We feeling Five Guys or the Cheesecake Factory?
Both.
Earn up to $120 a year in statement credits at participating partners. Up to $10 each month when you pay with the Amex Gold card. Learn more at americanexpress.com/explore-gold. Enrollment required. Terms apply.
Hello, and welcome to episode 226 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics in modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Today's episode comes out on Christmas Eve, a day steeped in nostalgia, memories, and sentiment. Whether it's music, food, family rituals, or even old disagreements, Christmas has a way of stirring the past. And that raises a question many of us feel but rarely examine. Is nostalgia good for us, or can it sometimes do harm? Two recent Psychology Today articles take opposite views. One argues too much nostalgia can trap us, and another insists that nostalgia is good for the soul. We'll use both as a starting point, but we'll go broader. What exactly is nostalgia? Why Christmas amplifies it? And we'll look at how our memories shape or distort our experience for the holidays. Rick, before we dive into psychology, let's start with the season itself. Do you agree that Christmas is, in fact, the most nostalgic time of the year?
Yes, and for two reasons. I think for many individuals, they experience nostalgia most strongly at this time of year. But I think just kind of objectively looking at what happens in our society, I mean, you have radio stations playing songs like White Christmas. What other time of the year do you get songs being played from the 1940s?
Oh, yeah.
On popular stations and in stores and
not just Mariah Carey.
Right. Yeah, true. And then like on TV, we're getting all the old Christmas specials and, you know, like It's a Wonderful Life, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. But those sorts of things get watched. And so people are reliving something about their own past. And you have people my age that talk fondly about the Christmas specials like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and A Charlie Brown Christmas. And then my kids like to rewatch Elf, right? Like it's the Christmas shows of their childhood. So you have people of all ages wanting to go back and relive something about their childhood. And I think that's great. I love that about Christmas.
Well, so I think we can absolutely agree that this is likely for most people the most nostalgic time of the year. I thought we'd at least split the first part of the show up into two parts. First, and again, these are some stories that were in Psychology Today, and I'm sure you can find arguments elsewhere online, but we'll link to those in the show notes. But one article talks about the nostalgia is good for the soul. It grounds us in relationships, purpose, and continuity. So I want us to start here by first making the argument about why nostalgia is good. So I think you may have shown your hand a little bit that may be the side you're on, but do you think it does help us stay better connected to our family and even the family members who are no longer with us?
Yeah, and I think it's generally good for us to know our story and to know a story that's connected with other people. And so by that, I mean having some kind of a narrative of our life that in which the present we're living in is connected to both the past and looks forward to the future. And that's not, I don't think we should be fully nostalgic. I don't think we should only look to the past, but we want to incorporate the past into our lives as we move into the future. And so there's a certain part of nostalgia that's really important. Otherwise, that we don't reconcile the past. We become disconnected from it.
And I think a lot of this is because as families, you know, multi-generations of families rarely live together, and in fact, rarely or often do not live even in the same community or region. This is a time where those people are often coming together and gathering around. And it only makes sense, right, that if you have an aunt or an uncle, or even a father and a mother who you don't see all the time, that you're going to think back to those, hopefully, happy memories of years gone by. And so much of our life is, I guess, routine is probably correct. And I mean, that's not a terrible thing, but like Christmas is definitely not routine. It only happens once a year. So I think it's understandable that those memories come back more clearly, and people realize that this is the time where you can sort of share those memories. And but I think the family part of this is just an unavoidable connection that sort of makes nostalgia even burn brighter right now.
And for many people, not everyone, but the family memories for that time of year are positive. And that's because it's for the most part, we're celebrating joy, connection, we're giving gifts. There's many times of the year where like our daily experience is not so pleasant, but then there's a time of year where like we really focus on that. And so most of us have some good memories, at least, of that time of year to think about and to connect us to family, connect us to past.
And, you know, everybody has different schedules at the end of December. But for many people, that week or so between Christmas and New Year's is not the busiest time of the year when it comes to work obligations or other things outside of spending time with family or just relaxing or sort of taking time to enjoy a less hectic life. And I think those things all add to why we view this time of the year fondly, because it is in many ways so different than like the other 50 or so weeks of the year that things do sort of slow down. I mean, I'm not going to make this argument because I'm not sure it's true. Part of me thinks that, gosh, wouldn't it be nice if that week of slowdown, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, was like in June or July, but I guess we're not going to change the entire calendar. But I think just that they're in, and you mentioned TV shows, but there's also things like, you know, decorations. We have things like recipes. It just seems like there's so many emotional pulls on us that it doesn't at all surprise me that for most people, this is just a time to relive all those good memories and maybe not pay as much attention to the bad memories.
Yeah. And I think it's important to have good memories and to relive them. Because what it helps us do is it leads us to try to recreate that in our present and like for our own children. Like I remember, especially when our children were young, like really wanting to share some things, like some recipes that my grandmother used to make, gingerbread men. And I remember really fondly going over to her house when I was like 5 or 6 years old and helping her one afternoon make all these gingerbread men. And I'm not a big fan of molasses cookies, but like one time of year making those and just taking one bite or even smelling these molasses cookies baking in the oven, it takes me right back to that place. And so then I want to recreate that for my kids. And so let's make gingerbread men. And so what I'm doing then is purposefully trying to create in them something of the experience that I remember fondly from my childhood. And that's a really important thing to do. I mean, we should be trying to create something like good memories, good experiences in the present. And a guide to that is what do we find like meaningful and remember fondly from our own past?
One question I always enjoy asking people is about their family's Christmas dinner traditions. I mean, nobody ever asks, or rarely do people ask, what did you have for Thanksgiving, Rick? Because the answer is almost always the same. I had turkey, I had dressing, I had the awful thing called green bean casserole, all these things that are like traditional. And, you know, you have some pie variances among families, but like it's like mostly the same. But it's interesting around Christmas is that there is no traditional anymore American Christmas dinner. And I think there's a lot of families have sort of developed their own traditions around what is they do every year, and it can vary quite wildly. What are yours? Is there something you grew up with, or is there something now that, like, yeah, every Christmas we get to gather around the table and have blank?
If we're hosting Christmas at our house, which we aren't this year, we'll do something that my mother's mother always made, was oyster stew.
And that's one I hear from time to time. I don't know if that's a Midwestern thing or more broadly. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. And so, like, and then they would always make fish. It would be deep fried fish. And because we did a lot of fishing up in that part of the country, we always had a lot of fish in the freezer. And so then and then they would make some shrimp, which was a real treat. I mean, we didn't have exotic foods back, you know, growing up in a small town in northern Minnesota, but
probably hard to find shrimp. Sometimes.
Yeah. So having deep fried shrimp and some fish, and then the oyster stew, which we had to try, like we had to take a bite or two, and we found it disgusting. Yeah, as kids. I remember it so fondly now, even though I hated it as a kid. I make it and nobody else eats it like this, but it fills the kitchen with smells. And the other thing, on the other side of my family, my grandmother made a dessert called tea ring, and it was kind of a cinnamon roll type of dessert with frosting and coconut and cherries on top, but it would be in a big circle like a wreath, and she never wanted anybody else to make it, so she never shared the recipe. And so I've tried, you know, different things. I don't know, like, it was all in her head. Like, she just made it all the time. But she was, so I've tried to recreate it. I haven't been able to hit upon exactly how she made the dough for it.
And for at least the past maybe 10, 15 years, I've been spending Christmas with Travis's family. And they have a tradition that goes long before I was going there, is that his mother makes homemade lasagna. And it's quite good. And I've even asked, like, how long have you been doing this, or why did this start? And nobody really seems to quite know, but it's just like, nobody even asks, like, what's for Christmas dinner? It's always just Pam's homemade lasagna.
And isn't it interesting that there's, like, for something like that, like, so many families will have a tradition that they started, but oftentimes don't know why it started or how it started, but that's what they do, and they always do it, and that's then what becomes significant about it, is like, this is what we do.
So now we're going to take the other side of the argument as best we can, and the article we'll link to says that nostalgia can sometimes be a trap. It idealizes the past, can distort the present, and maybe most importantly, to create pressure to find something that was, well, never quite real. Do you think these idealized Christmas memories can set unrealistic expectations for today's holiday? Or is that just people looking for something to worry about?
No, I think absolutely. I know people who put so much pressure to create the perfect Christmas or perfect holidays.
From decorations. And we haven't even talked about
and everything else.
Like Christmas tree decorations, yeah. Which is like sometimes a ode to like memories of yesteryear.
Oh, and I love it. My wife and I just like a week or so ago, just because we're recording this well in advance,
yes, of
Christmas Eve. It was about a week ago. We dug out all the ornaments and hung them on the tree. And we have ornaments, a couple ornaments that my grandmother made. So they're over 60 years old, and some that that are from last year. And so pulling out the ornaments is kind of reliving all of these Christmas pasts for years, and they all have memories, and I love it. That's one of my favorite nights of the year, is the night that we decorate the tree. But I was talking about that the trap is like these expectations that it be perfect, or that it somehow meets this idealized expectation of what our Christmas was in the past. And of course it never does, because memory is idealized often. And so I know some people that just make Christmas miserable because their expectations are so high, it doesn't live up to that. Or the people aren't acting the way they want them to act, or whatever it happens to be. And they don't enjoy it at all. And, And that's too bad because they are stuck in that nostalgia trap.
And there are also people who are listening to this saying most of what we've talked about so far are these relatively traditional large family gatherings around Christmas trees and quirky and unique holiday meal traditions and gift giving. But there's not an insignificant number of people who, because of estrangement or because of death or because of distance, are spending Christmas really kind of alone. And I think there are times either when you're looking back to your childhood and remembering all those hopefully good experiences you had growing up around Christmas, or hearing people like us talk about, isn't it great how we get to see all the people we love over that, you know, week-long period. There's some people who are just more than happy to pick up a double shift at work if they're, you know, because they don't want to think about their current station in life and how it isn't quite as the best and wonderful time of the year.
Yeah, but I, you know, it doesn't have to be. I think what we find meaningful is just connection, being in the presence of others, and especially being in the loving presence of others. And that is something we can provide. Like, it isn't something that, like, we should put the obligation on others to do for us. It is something we should try to provide. And then you find the magic coming alive again as soon as you think of it that way. Like, who is there within my circle that I can help to make this day meaningful for them, and then try to do it.
And I guess sort of the question is, if you're in that situation, maybe you're, you know, looking for making those connections, can you, like, intentionally think to yourself, gosh, I want to start a new tradition that I'm going to do this year, and hopefully I'll be doing this for many years to come, business? Or do those traditions, like, sort of happen serendipitously? Like, you know, like Pam's homemade lasagna. I'm sure the first year she made that, she didn't think, I'm going to be doing this for 25 more years every Christmas Eve. I don't think that's probably what she thought. So I guess, do those traditions come organically, or can they be intentional, or is it maybe a mix of both?
It's a mix of both. And children are just tradition-making creatures. I mean, you do something once for a kid who's like 4 years old, and they say, we always do it this way. And like, well, because we did it that way last year. And like, they're focused on those patterns that they can recognize and predict. And so it's very easy for children to form traditions, or if you're a parent or grandparent, to create new traditions for children. But for yourself, I think you can just decide, yeah, this is something I want to do, and do intentionally, and keep doing. I want to share with you one of my favorite memories from Christmas that happened, not because I tried to create it, and doesn't go back to my childhood, and it's something I talk about in my latest book on Third Places. It was this guy who was homeless, who I had befriended, and I had brought him a gift, a basket of fruit, you know, like shortly before the holidays. And he shows up Christmas morning, knocks on the door, and he's got this big white beard, and he's got a big belly. So he kind of looks like Santa, even though he's wearing a black turtleneck. Like, shows up at our door, and he has a brown paper bag with some gifts in it. And the gifts are wrapped in newspaper. And he just wishes us a Merry Christmas and says hello, and then off he goes. And I take this bag in the house, and it's four packages that are books that he had purchased at the public library's annual book sale, where he paid like 10 cents a piece for them. And they were all thoughtfully chosen. And it was such a beautiful gesture. It was so nice. And like, he had bought something for me and my wife and for our kids. And I look back on that really fondly, and it's not a tradition, something, mm-hmm. but I look back on it now with nostalgia. It's like, that is one of the, like, I don't remember what else we did that Christmas. I remember that moment. It was really meaningful. And that was like such a gift that he gave to me and to our family. That's all it takes to create these moments that can then become quite nostalgic in, I think, a healthy way. But we have to give up our expectations that we recreate exactly what we recall from an idealized past. We have to stay open to like new things that happen that could be meaningful, that create new memories for us going forward.
As we're about to all, or many of us, gather with family and friends over the next week or so, there'll be plenty of chances to share stories just like that about these Christmas memories, sometimes years ago, sometimes decades ago. And I'm curious your thoughts on this. As we're sharing those stories, and we'll just say that, you know, these are often stories about people who are no longer with us, or people who at least aren't at that particular family gathering. And you're kind of telling these warm, heartfelt stories that maybe provide a look at, you know, some spiritual or other nice way to look at this season. Are we required to always be 100% truthful in these retellings, or do we have the ability at times to sort of sand over the rough edges and just make the story seem a little, I don't think you create something out of whole cloth, but maybe make them a little friendlier or a little more appropriate for the season? I mean, where do you sit on those sort of issues?
Well, yeah, of course, like whenever we tell a story from the past, we are being selective, mm-hmm. whether it's intentionally selective or unintentionally. Like, that's just the way our memories work. And that's perfectly fine. And so I told this story of this guy who's homeless who came to our door and shared, like, I didn't also have to share with you that he didn't smell very good.
Yeah.
Right. I don't have to share mm-hmm. that. And that's mm-hmm. like, that's not, it's not part of what I choose to remember. But if then I go back and say like, well, was there anything about that occasion that wasn't very positive? Well, yeah, he hadn't showered for a long time because he's homeless. Yeah. He didn't smell very good. You know, it's like, I don't have to share that.
You're not like a news reporter here. Right. You're not trying to capture every, you know, unbiased fact.
Right. That's how we tell stories. So there's nothing wrong with that.
Those stories, the best ones at least, are ones that we hope get passed down from generation to generation. And I think, you know, any, like, what's that old telephone thing where, you know, I tell a story to you and then you tell it to somebody else, and like five people later, the story comes out quite different. But like, that's probably fine, right? If it is sort of the retelling sort of still brings back those warm holiday theme memories. And I think that's probably what you're saying. It's probably fine, right? That we may not be, or none of us are great narrators of our own life as far as how accurate things are. I think we're all selective in the stories we tell, and frankly, oftentimes want to make us look good in the telling.
Yeah. And I think there's a way in which we're telling stories that help us somehow to shape our lives, how we're acting and how we're interacting with others. And so part of what you do when in shaping stories in a positive way is you're creating the expectation that I am going to act in such a way that I kind of become that kind of person that I represent in these stories. Now, sometimes it's funny and doing kind of foolish things, and there's a little bit of humility involved in that. But sometimes it's acts of generosity or kindness. And those are often the kinds of stories that we wish we recall, but they're also like characteristics that we wish to embody going forward. So that's a good thing.
As I was preparing for the show, I was forcing myself to remember sort of some childhood memories I have around Christmas. And every time I do that, I come back to this one. And I may have even told it on this show a few years ago, but I'll tell it again. And I think there's probably like a life lesson here I learned, but it is not maybe the warm and fuzzy Christmas memory everybody has. But I have a sister who's 8 years older than I am. So you know, that's far enough apart that, you know, we, you know, a lot of the, we didn't have share a lot of the same interests growing up. I'm, you know, a 5-year-old doesn't have a lot in common with a 15 or a 13-year-old, right? So there is sort of that gap. But I remember one year, my sister, who was, you know, good in school and a good curious person, got a chemistry set. And she thought it was really cool. And I mean, I wasn't really around her when she used it, but she would, you know, do all these things. And I mean, I had this vague recollection that she really enjoyed this. And it kind of is this like thing as a kid, you don't even know quite what it is. And it's sort of this mysterious thing. And so a number of years went by. And I thought to myself, you know, I kind of thought about that. And my sister had this chemistry set, which I'm sure by this point had was no longer around. So I thought, wow, I'm going to ask for a chemistry set. And that's like any time that season, what do you want for Christmas? I want a chemistry set because I just thought it would be the coolest thing. And guess what was under the tree that year, Rick?
A chemistry set.
And I opened it up and I realized I had zero interest in this. It was entirely based on like something that seemed like a cool idea. And then, I mean, and.
But is that a fond memory now?
Well, I'll tell you what.
It was disappointment at the time.
It was disappointment at the time. But the deal, what sticks with me the most, and I don't know how much chemistry sets cost back then. And the whole other sort of side conversation here is I don't even think you can buy chemistry sets anymore. Is that even a thing?
I don't think so.
I don't know.
They were big.
They were big kids. Yeah, and as I'm telling the story, I don't even, like, were there things in there that you're just not supposed to have?
I mean, order it from Sears, from the catalog.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, so this big mysterious thing arrives, and I unwrap. And in my mind, I assumed, and maybe rightly and maybe wrongly, that this was, like, expensive. It might not have been. But it's like, I thought it was. And so then I have this thing. And I, in my mind, thinking they spent all, my parents spent a lot of money on this, and we weren't poor, a poor family, but we were middle class at best. So I'm like, wow, they dropped a fair amount of money on this. So I felt like guilty, like I really should like this. So I like caught myself a few times like, okay, we need to go and like pretend to enjoy this. But I'm like, I didn't even know what to do. And my parents like had no interest in it. So they were going to sit down with me and show me, and my sister, who I think truly enjoyed hers many years before, was not going to tutor her younger brother on how best to do this. So it just sat, and you know, it's like one of those things that just sort of after a while disappeared. I don't know if my parents like just threw it away at some point. I mean, and maybe they should have been more careful where they threw it away. I don't know what was even in it. But so I guess if there is like a lesson, it sort of like is be careful what you wish for, right? Because, I mean, there were certain other gifts. I was kind of into Matchbox cars, and I wanted this parking garage, oddly enough, that you could like put your cars in. And I got that, and it was great. I was like, that was like, I was super. So there were times where I got things that I thought were cool and fun. But the chemistry set always sticks in my mind as like, gosh, I really thought I wanted this. And I even like think like as I was opening it, I'm like, maybe I don't want this after all. But like, how do you, you can't say that if like that's all you've been talking about the weeks leading up to Christmas. So probably not the best childhood nostalgic memory, but that's the one that really sticks with me.
You know, the memory that sticks with me is also like a memory of a great disappointment.
Okay.
But I look back on fondly now, the winter before, some friends had taken me skiing, downhill skiing for the first time. They had had an extra set of skis and they let me use, and I just fell in love with it. They also had a big hill behind their house, and we would ski behind their house, and I would use a pair of their skis. But this was in the days like just strap them on something. But so I wanted a pair of modern skis with actual bindings, and so I asked for that for Christmas. Now, we didn't have much money, and so I knew it was a real stretch. My folks said, well, I don't know Santa can afford that. I come down to Christmas Day, and here's this pair of black, painted black boards with cable bindings. Like, these were, even like in the 1970s, these would have been like from the 50s, like
mm-hmm. style,
that they had ordered from Sears. And I think they, if I remember right, it cost them $12 for this. And I just burst out in tears. Mm. Like they were just not usable. My parents had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt so bad that they said, like, well, we didn't realize, you know, we ordered them. We thought they'd be fine. And then they arrived and they, you know, like, they're, we realize they're not very good. But if you would agree that we'll get you another pair, a better pair, we'll return these, but it'll have to be your birthday present as well, which was several months later. And I agreed to that. And what I remember so warmly is their response.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it a good Christmas, though, like, on that day, I was just terribly disappointed. But I remember it more strongly than the years where I got something that I really wanted. And some years earlier than that, I had gotten a chemistry set.
Oh, you did get one. Did you enjoy that?
Oh, I loved it. I used it all the time. Really? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to spend time on my phone as we record this, but I do plan later today to go into the Google and see, like, A, can you still buy these? And B, like, what was in them? I mean, do you remember what was in those? Like,
well, I remember there was test tubes and like a little, like a burner, and they'd have a couple flasks.
But I just remember there were these, like, baby jar size containers of all sorts of
all kinds of chemicals.
And I'm just like, what were those? And, like, should they have been giving those to kids? And, like, how do you dispose of them responsibly?
I know, because I was putting them in test tubes and burning them over flames and trying to see what would happen. And there probably was noxious fumes and everything else. And my parents had no idea what I was doing with that chemistry set down in the basement.
Yeah. Well, did the house ever blow up?
No, it didn't.
Well,
but I did some really dumb things. Like one of them was a container for calcium, and I had used it up in some experience. I thought, like, where do I get more calcium? So I read somewhere that there's calcium in water. So I thought, I can just boil away water and the residue will be calcium. Well, I didn't realize there's a lot of other minerals too. But I would take, like, quarts of water and put a pot on the stove and boil it away, like, for an hour, to scrape a little tiny bit of calcium. And, like, my parents had no idea that I'm, like, burning up all this gas.
Well, one last thing before I close, and I'll preface it by this. How often does your wife listen to this show?
She listens to it more than I do.
Well, so, and again, this won't come out till Christmas Eve. So, Cindy, if you're listening, now would be a good time to turn off the show. Now that she has,
okay.
I'll ask you, do you and Cindy typically exchange Christmas gifts?
We typically do.
Okay.
And we haven't talked about, I don't think we are going to this year.
Okay.
We are taking a trip together just before Christmas because our children can't come home for Christmas. So we're traveling to see them. And this is kind of our Christmas present to one another.
And I believe you're taking a trip a couple weeks later too.
Yeah. So we'll be doing, we'll probably do some little gift for one another, but we're not doing any kind of big gift.
And people find this odd, but and if Travis is listening, this won't come as a surprise. We just really don't exchange gifts. We haven't for a long time. I mean, we're taking a trip mid-January to Puerto Rico. So I guess that's sort of like our gift to each other. If, like, I spent a whole long time thinking about it, I could probably come up with, like, a good, thoughtful gift. But we're lucky enough in some ways that, like, if there's something we need, we'll just get it for ourselves. And we're not, like, that, you know, we don't have tons of things we, like, urgently need. So, I sometimes worry that that's just, like, the lazy way out, that we're like, oh, well, let's take a trip and that'll be our gift. But I just don't feel like either of us feel like we're, like, missing out on some, you know, big unwrapping moment. And that works for us, but I realize that may not work for everyone.
You know, the last few years when our children have come home for Christmas, what we've done is we've exchanged stocking stuffers. So everybody buys, like one little thing that'll fit in a stocking, and then we all, like, go through stockings, but we don't buy gifts for one another in the family like we used to. And people seem happier with that because it is a burden, especially if you live in a fairly prosperous society where most of us take care of our regular needs. So there's not something that we're going without that we really need. You end up buying people junk, things that they don't need. And there's a big burden, like, within a family of trying to get gifts for all these people when they don't really need anything. We've opted out of that.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, I bet you have one for me.
Yeah, Scott, let's say that you've agreed to make a long trip to give a presentation for your company, and you've agreed with your boss that you'll do this. But then you find out that a snowstorm is on the way. And if you're going to travel, there's no way of avoiding this bad weather. Like, at what point do you say, like, the weather's just too bad? So your boss is minimizing, say, oh, yeah, the weather, you'll probably be fine, is encouraging you to go, but you're really not feeling that this would be safe. At what point do you just say, I'm not going because I don't feel safe on the roads for this kind of trip?
And I think you outlined it in the example you gave me ahead of the show. It's like, what, 3-hour drive or something?
3-hour yeah. drive. And say, and lots of times when you get predictions for a snowstorm, it'll be a range.
Yeah,
like,
of course.
Like 3 to 8 inches predicted over the next 12 hours. Like, but you don't know exactly what it's going to be.
So, and it's funny you mentioned that, because about a little over a month ago, I did do a 3-hour trip for work to talk to some people in our company. And when I traveled, the weather was like perfectly clear and fine. And so I thought to myself, what if the weather would have been bad? It was in mid-November. So, I mean, maybe there could have been a snowstorm brewing in Wisconsin. It made me realize, as I was thinking about that, that I am, and really, as far as I know, for like most of my professional life, which is, you know, not just a few days, I've been really lucky. Like, I can't think of I was trying to think of a situation like, well, this time my boss wouldn't have said what, you know, you said, but, oh, that boss I had 5 years ago, he or she would have been like, you know, I guess I'm really lucky. I can't think of anybody I would have worked for that would have said, hey, I know this snowstorm's coming and I know they're saying it's not safe to travel, or this snowstorm's coming and I'm sure it'll be fine. Don't listen to what the TV meteorologists are saying. They always overhype these things. You know, you just need to be there and just find a way to do it. And maybe it'll take you, instead of 3 hours, it'll take you 5.5, because you'll have to either go real slow or go in some really ridiculous route to avoid some of the worst weather, but do it anyway. I don't think I've ever worked for someone like that. So I guess I should consider myself lucky, because I'm sure people do. But if I did find myself working for someone in that way, what I probably would do is say, and I'm on the scale of the ability or the comfort level of driving through that weather, I'm probably on that scale on the, I err on the side of a little more caution. I'm not with the person who's going to be like, oh, it won't be that bad, I'll just trudge through. I mean, I probably have done that, but I've never enjoyed it. And I think in our state and in most states, I think, that have winter weather conditions, the Department of Transportation has some sort of website. I think this is like almost now the same key or the same that you can kind of log on to it. And it says like good winter driving conditions, roads partially covered because of snow and ice, roads entirely covered of snow and ice, and then travel not recommended, and then like the roads closed.
So they're, and think they're usually color-coded,
yes,
on
like
the map.
Green,
right?
Pink, blue, black, I forget exactly. And I mean, the two states I pay most closely attention to are Minnesota and Wisconsin, and like the color key is the same for each state. So maybe this is something that's everywhere, I don't really know. But I would probably say to my boss, you know, it's a 3-hour drive, so I'll give myself a little extra time as the weather's not perfect. But like, if like 5 hours before I'm going to leave, if I log onto that site and if it's green, which is perfectly fine, or even maybe pink, which is like a little problem here or there, I'll go. But if it is blue or whatever the color may be worse than that, I'm not going to do it. And I just can't imagine somebody saying, well, you know, I mean, I'm not, I mean, I don't perform brain surgery, Rick. I don't design rocket boosters. You know, what I'm doing is helpful and useful, but it's not like saving people's lives. So because of that, I think I would hope, and I would think I could make the argument that it is not worth putting myself in danger to go somewhere that I could easily have that conversation either in person a week later, or because of the modern technology we all have that conversation through Zoom or some other related product. So I guess to answer your question, I would kind of rely on that third party advice that most states provide. But thankfully, I'm lucky, I guess, that I have never found myself in that position.
You know, I hadn't thought about that. I like the idea of using something like that road conditions app mm-hmm. as a way of having a third party say, like, this is how we're going to determine whether it's safe or not to travel.
Yeah.
I thought of this because about a week ago, I had to travel to the northern part of the state, northern Wisconsin, and there was a pretty big snowstorm came through where I was that night. It stopped early the next morning, but then when I was on the road getting back for some meetings back on my campus, like, there was a lot of cars in the ditch that had just gone in the ditch, you know, as I was driving. I was like, maybe could have delayed a couple hours to let the roads get in even better shape, but I didn't. But I was thinking, like I don't really know, like, at what point do I say, you know, like, it's just too bad. And I've used those apps in the past. I didn't think of it doing it that morning. I probably should have mm-hmm. because the roads were actually worse than I had anticipated.
And so I'll ask kind of a related spin out question on that before we go. The first big winter storm hit our region, and we had tickets to a performance in the city about an hour from where we live. And we had purchased the tickets months ago, and it was an evening performance. And I was probably more firm on this, but Travis and I talked, and I said, you know, I just don't feel with the forecast coming up that I want to make the trip there and back to see this show because I just don't feel it's safe. And it's not like, I mean, it would have been a nice show to see, but it's not like, you know, it's just a show, right? It's not going to change our lives. And he said, well, is the show still going to happen? So I emailed the venue and said, hey, I'm coming from an hour away. I just thought I would see if the show is still going on and what, you know, and we're driving an hour and are hesitant to make the trip. What do you think? And they wrote back saying that the performer can't get to the city because they're, you know, because of flight cancellations and what have you. And they said, if for whatever reason the performer can't make it to the venue, we'll cancel. But if the performer is able to be there, and they, I think, had reason to believe he would be, that the show goes on and the tickets are non-refundable, and that's the way it is. So I admittedly should have just said thank you for the information. I did write back saying something to the effect of, well, I'm glad that the bottom line is more important than the safety of the people coming to your concert. And I didn't hear anything back. And I go, and it was kind of a snarky reply. But do you understand the venue's position that obvious? I mean, I'm sure, but I think I purchased these through like Ticketmaster. And like, you know, whenever you make a purchase like that, there's like 77 pages of disclosures and terms and stuff that I'm sure I agreed to that said that, you know, if the show goes on and you can't make it, well, we're real sorry. So
is there insurance available now where you can insure something if it's due to weather? But I mean,
these were like $25 tickets. Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, I don't think.
I think for these really expensive tickets.
Yeah, like if it was Taylor Swift, maybe, or I could have. I mean, and also I'm sure if it was like a higher demand thing, I could have like gone on the second, you know, tried to like sell it through one of those sites. But again, it was not a big amount of money. But like, I mean, that was kind of a snarky reply and whatever. I probably should have done it. But like, do you think the venue if you were running that venue, would you have any hesitation to say, well, I know that our performer happens to be here. And I mean, although we sold 5,000 tickets and only 1,500 people showed up and we're sure it's because of the weather. Yeah, that's just the way life goes.
No, especially if you're in conditions like where schools had closed and that sort of thing, where there and there's travel advisory. So you have the weather service saying you shouldn't be on the roads.
Yeah, and it was a weekend, so there weren't school closures. But I mean, yeah, I think there were. But if I lived in that city, I would have gone like a mile to go see this, of course.
I would think the responsible thing to do, not that I expect these venues to do it, but would be to offer refunds to people that could not make it, but still offer it. If that mm-hmm. performer's there, go ahead and do the event.
Yeah.
The first year that I started working the job I currently have, I'm director of the Institute for Ethics and Leadership, where we bring in speakers for things. And I brought in a speaker that came in March from Montana, and he'd flown in the day before, and he was national expert on hunting ethics. And there was quite a bit of interest in him, and he'd written some pretty well-known books. And then we had an ice storm the day of the event.
Which
and he's already
March,
there.
Yeah.
He was scheduled to fly out the next day. Schools had closed. Everything was shut down. In fact, our university closed.
Mm.
But he's already there, and the event was free. So I thought, well, we might as well have him speak for the people that live close by. They can still come, and we'll just see who shows up. And I was expecting maybe we'll get 50 people. But he's here, and then he's leaving the next day. Why not have him talk? We had about 300 people show up, and our parking lot was filled with four-wheel drive trucks. It was the only time I've seen our Fine Arts Center parking lot filled with these big pickups or people. And, you know, they made sure that they could get there no matter the weather.
And hunting people may have more likely to have such vehicles.
Right. And that's kind of what happened. But in that case, we weren't charging people. Mm-hmm. We were just saying, as long as he's already here, we're going to hold the event, even though everything else is closed. And I think that was okay to do. I don't think I should be the one that has to judge whether others are taking too much of a risk. That's kind of the position I was thinking.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also be sure to check out Rick's column, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kide, I am Scott Rada. We wish everyone listening a Merry Christmas, and thank you for listening.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.